fat, leaving only their tails exposed. These tails repulse each other, preventing the fat droplets from coalescing and suddenly making the water seem much more attractive to them. A bit like adding a few kegs of beer to that nerd fest to mix things up a little. To make a traditional mayonnaise, egg yolks, water, salt, and a few flavorings, usually Dijon mustard and lemon juice or vinegar, are whisked together vigorously, while the oil is simultaneously slowly drizzled into the mixture. A food processor makes this process nearly foolproof. As the oil falls into the bowl, the rapid action of the whisk quickly breaks it up into tiny droplets, which are kept suspended with the help of the emulsifiers in the egg yolk. Here's what happens to that mayonnaise in the bowl as you add more and more oil to it. When the oil and water is at a 1-to-1 ratio, or 1 with less oil, there is no possibility of a stable emulsion forming. The fat won't break up and get coated by the water, nor will the water be able to suspend the fat within it. At this stage, your mayonnaise looks like a thin, cloudy liquid. As the oil-to-water ratio approaches a 3-to-1, your mixture begins to resemble a mayonnaise, albeit one that flows more like a vinaigrette. As more and more oil is incorporated into the emulsion, the mayonnaise starts to become opaque because the tiny drops of oil refract light differently than a liquid mass of oil. As the ratio passes a 5-to-1, the mayonnaise begins to get much thicker, thick enough that the peaks will hold when you pull the whisk out of it. It seems counterintuitive. Mayonnaise is thick. Oil is so thin. So adding oil to mayonnaise should make it thinner, right? Wrong. We know that oil droplets in a sea of oil can swim around and float past each other quite freely, and that in an emulsion, they are trapped in a tight matrix of droplets separated by water. In order to flow, that water needs to be able to move freely around the system. As you add more and more oil to the mayonnaise, the water separating each droplet of oil gets stretched thinner and thinner, severely limiting its movement. Eventually, if you keep adding oil, the mayonnaise will start to turn from creamy and luscious to pasty and overly thick. Try it now, and it will coat your mouth like candle wax. There isn't enough water in the emulsion to adequately coat each of the oil droplets, and they end up spilling out and breaking. Your mayonnaise turns greasy. So, the key to a nice, creamy mayonnaise is to adjust the ratio of oil to water until you get the exact consistency you're looking for. Since I already know that, flavor-wise, I like to use about 1 egg per cup, the rest is just a matter of adding a little water, a drop at a time, to the finished product until it thins out to the consistency I'm after. Foolproofing. The rate at which the oil is added is a key factor in determining whether or not your mayonnaise will be successful. Looking back at the metaphor of a college mixer, imagine that only 1 or 2 MIT boys trickle into that girl's college mixer at a time. The emulsifiers have a fairly easy time of separating them from each other and getting them into the mix of things, completely surrounding them with girls. A steady stream of nerds is easy to mix, so long as they trickle into the party slowly. Now imagine the opposite. A whole group of them suddenly shows up at once, clinging tightly to each other. Suddenly, it's much harder to get them to mix nicely. Not only that, but any nerds who have already been inserted into the fray will see this large group of nerds who just entered and have a strong desire to join them. So it is with oil. Trickle it into the egg yolk base slowly, and you can form a strong, stable emulsion. Pour it in too rapidly, and you'll never be able to separate it into droplets small enough. And, what's worse, even if you've already formed a stable emulsion, you run the risk of breaking it. This is the great difficulty when it comes to mayonnaise, and it vexes even the best of cooks. Mayonnaise is one of my favorite foods. I'm not one of those folks who wakes up in the middle of the night and pulls a jar out of the fridge to eat with a spoon, at least not yet, but I've made a lot of it in my life. Some people swear by the food processor, but the easiest method by far is the very method that I witnessed on that infomercial all those years ago, using an immersion blender. By placing the egg yolks and other flavorings, usually mustard and lemon juice, along with a splash of water to lighten the texture, into the bottom of a tall, narrow cup, and carefully pouring oil on top, you create two distinct layers, water-based liquid with the fat floating on top of it. If you then slowly plunge the head of the blender to the bottom, into the water part, and flip the switch, you create a vortex that slowly but surely pulls the oil down into it, so the oil is fed into the blended egg yolks in a slow, steady stream. Before your very eyes, you see a creamy mayonnaise forming, starting from the bottom of the container and slowly working its way toward the top. If you don't own an immersion blender, get one, if only for this purpose. Foolproof mayo without a hand blender. Okay, you're stubborn, and you flat out refuse to buy an immersion blender. What then? Well, you could make your mayonnaise by hand. It's really, really tough. But if you've got a food processor, you're in luck. With enough practice, you can easily make mayonnaise in the food processor by dumping your eggs and flavorings in, then slowly trickling in the oil with the machine running. Problem is, it doesn't always work, particularly for small batches. The egg yolks ride up the sides of the processor bowl, which makes any attempt to form an emulsion with them an exercise in futility. But is there a foolproof way? One that ensures that the oil and the egg yolks all mix up nicely? As I was scraping down egg yolks from the sides of my processor bowl and pondering this very question, a thought occurred to me. Rather than stopping the processor every few seconds to scrape down egg yolks, why didn't I just introduce an element to the bowl that would scrape them down for me as the processor was running? And, on top of that, why didn't I make sure that the element I introduced also added oil to the mix at a very slow, steady rate? If I could do that, then the mayonnaise should basically make itself once I've added all the ingredients to the bowl, right? Here's what I was thinking. Frozen cubes of oil. By freezing the oil, I transformed it from a liquid into a solid that releases liquid at a slow and steady rate in the processor, all the while bouncing around against the walls to ensure that the egg yolks and flavorings don't stay perched up where the blades of the processor can't reach them. I tested my theory by mixing up a batch of mayonnaise in the food processor, simply dumping all the other ingredients into it along with a few frozen cubes of oil. I switched on the processor and watched everything jump around. It was a little erratic at first as the oil cubes bounced around their prison, and then slowly but surely, things started to smooth out. And within moments, I had a full-on creamy, tangy, perfect mayonnaise. The only other thing to think about is flavorings. A basic mayonnaise needs nothing more than some mustard and lemon juice, but more often than not, I'll add garlic to the mix, a clove per egg is about right, as well as some extra virgin olive oil. Extra virgin olive oil should always be whisked in by hand. Using an immersion blender or food processor will turn it bitter. How much mayo can I make with one egg? Because lecithin is such a powerful emulsifier, you can create a very large amount of mayonnaise using a single egg yolk. The mayonnaise manufacturers gleaned this fact long ago, which is one of the reasons mayonnaise is so cheap. The most expensive component, the eggs, makes up only a tiny percentage of the finished product. In order to do this without the emulsion breaking, you need to be mindful of the ratio of oil to water. As the mayonnaise becomes thicker and thicker and is on the verge of breaking, just after the pasty stage, if you incorporate some water into the mix to reestablish the correct ratio, you can then continue to add more oil. Using this process, I've managed to make over a gallon of mayo with a single egg yolk. That said, the ideal mayonnaise needs to have a certain amount of egg yolk in it for flavoring purposes. A mostly oil mayo just doesn't taste right. I find that the ideal ratio is a single large egg yolk for each cup of mayonnaise. Mayonnaise versus aioli. Anytime I dine out at a fancy restaurant and see the chef using the word aioli when he or she really means mayonnaise, I make it a point to inform the waiter, my wife, and perhaps a few of the surrounding tables of the chef's loose lexical morals and the liberties he or she is taking by obfuscating two of the world's great sauces. The word aioli comes from the Occitan and is a contraction of ai, garlic, and OLI, oil. A true aioli is made by smashing garlic cloves in a mortar with a pestle, then slowly drizzling in olive oil at a drop at a time until a smooth emulsion is formed. It's an intensely spicy, pungent sauce, often served with seafood and croutons or boiled potatoes. The Spanish version, aioli, is commonly served with olives, grilled meats, or grilled vegetables. These days, it's perfectly acceptable to call a garlic-flavored mayonnaise made with egg yolks and mustard aioli, but it must contain some garlic. So why do restaurant menus refer to a creamy, emulsified, egg-based sauce as aioli when there's not a hint of garlic in it? It's a matter of public perception. Despite the fact that mayonnaise at one point was considered a staple of haute cuisine, its use on menus fell out of fashion because it became associated too strongly with cheap, everyday food. I'm a fancy restaurant chef. I can't very well serve the same stuff people are slathering on their sandwiches. Luckily, this silliness seems to be disappearing, with more and more chefs unafraid to love mayonnaise for what it is: creamy, rich, and delicious. I am certain that my mid-meal lectures to waitstaff, despite the dirty looks it earns me from my lovely wife, have played no small role in effecting this change, and I intend to soon move on to ensuring that bruschetta is never again pronounced with a soft SH sound. Classic American potato salad. Potato salad. Big deal, right? It's kind of like background music in a restaurant. Something to keep you and your fellow diners distracted and occupied during the awkward silences before the main course arrives. You put an obligatory spoonful on your paper plate and poke at it with a plastic fork until the burgers are done. At least, that's what most potato salad is. The problem is, it's such a simple dish that it's often made without thought. Boil the potatoes, toss them with some mayo, add a few dollops of whatever condiments catches your fancy, and throw it into a bowl. But a well-constructed potato salad can be as interesting as the burger it precedes. And you know by now how I feel about burgers. Tangy, salty, and sweet, with a texture that's simultaneously creamy, crunchy, and fluffy, a perfect potato salad should taste feather-light despite being made with potatoes and mayo, two of the heaviest ingredients around. The way I see it, there are three things that can go wrong with a potato salad. Screw up any one of these, and you're quickly going south. The potatoes are not flavored all the way to the center. In a good potato salad, the pieces of potato should be seasoned all the way through. Their hearty, earthy flavor does fine on its own, or with a bit of salt when hot, but when cold, it comes across as heavy and bland. Without plenty of acid and a bit of sweetness to brighten it up, potato salad is dead in the water. The potatoes are under or overcooked. If there's one thing I can't stand, it's al dente potatoes. Potatoes should not be crunchy or firm, nor do you want your potato salad to be cold, mashed potatoes. The perfect piece of potato should be tender and fluffy all the way through, with the edges just barely beginning to break down, adding a bit of potato flavor and body to the dressing. The salad is under-seasoned. Foods that are served cold need to be seasoned more aggressively than foods that are served hot. Our taste buds are less receptive at colder temperatures. Combine this with the heaviness of potatoes, and it makes sense that a potato salad needs to have more vinegar, sugar, spice, and salt than most other dishes. But balance is key. All the elements need to come together instead of competing. Hot and cold. The first step is getting the texture just right. Potatoes are made up of a series of cells that contain starch granules. These cells are glued together with pectin. As the potatoes cook, the pectin slowly breaks down and the starch granules start absorbing water. When you overcook them, the first thing that happens is the pectin breaks down too much. The potato cells start falling away, and the whole thing turns mushy. Welcome to Cold Mashed Potato City, population U. Overcook them even more, and the starch granules will swell so much that they'll begin to burst, turning a mildly offensive bowl of cold mashed potato salad into an outright disrespectful bowl of gluey, inedible goo. Undercooked potatoes, on the other hand, and they remain crunchy, and crunchy potatoes are grounds for immediate ejection from the backyard. It gets even more complex. Since potatoes heat up from the exterior toward the center, it's possible to have a potato that's simultaneously overcooked and undercooked. The best way to accomplish this feat of culinary indecency is to drop your cut potatoes into a pot of already boiling water. When potatoes start in hot water, the outside will rapidly overcook before the center has even got the chill off it. Make a salad with these, and you'll have crunchy nuggets of uncooked potato swimming in a sea of gluey mash. No thanks. If you start the potatoes in cold water, the potatoes heat up evenly right along with the water, so that by the time they are perfectly cooked in the center, the edges have just barely started to break apart, which is not a bad thing. I like a little bit of broken up potato to thicken and flavor the dressing. This, by the way, is the best method any time you boil potatoes. Of course, even with a cold start, one problem remains. Potatoes require constant vigilance. They can go from undercooked to overcooked in an instant. Get distracted for just a minute, say to chase after your puppy who's just peed on your backpack, then hidden your notebook under the couch, and you've got gluey potatoes on your hands. There is a way to solve this problem, which we'll get back to, but first, 'tis the season. Using russet potatoes is key for this style of potato salad. Not only do they absorb dressing more easily, but their starches actually help to bind the salad better. To prove that they do absorb seasoning better, I boiled russet and red potatoes, cut them into cubes, and tossed them with a dressing tinted with a bit of green food coloring. For some time, I'd thought that it's better to season your potatoes when they are hot, but I'd never actually figured out why. Do they actually absorb more seasoning, or could it just be a psychosomatic effect? To find out, I cooked 3 separate batches of potatoes, this time using green food coloring as a stand-in for the salt and vinegar. The first batch I cooked in green-colored water. The second batch I cooked in plain water, then seasoned with green-colored water after draining them while they were still hot. I allowed the last batch to cool completely before tossing with green water. After all the batches cooled completely, I cut a cube from each one in half to see how far the food coloring had penetrated. The potato that was cooked in seasoned water and the one that was seasoned while still hot were a light shade of green all the way to their centers, while the potato that was seasoned after cooling was mostly pale in the center with a single green streak where a natural fault in the potato existed. The reason for this is twofold. First, the cooked starch on the surface of the potatoes hardens and gelatinizes as it cools, making it harder for anything to penetrate. Second, as the potatoes cool, they contract and tighten up slightly, making it harder for any seasoning to work its way into the center, even if it manages to make it past the gelatinized starch sheath on the exterior. As you will have noticed, whether the potatoes were cooked in seasoned water or seasoned immediately after coming out of plain water made very little difference in terms of flavor penetration. So, you might just as well add the vinegar to the potatoes after they're cooked, right? But there's actually a very good reason to add a little vinegar to the potatoes' cooking water. It helps prevent them from overcooking, something we'll see again when exploring French fries in Chapter 9. Pectin breaks down much more slowly in acidic environments. I found that adding a tablespoon of vinegar per quart of water to my potato pot prevented the potatoes from becoming mushy, even when slightly overcooked. Balancing act. Once the potatoes were perfectly cooked, light, and bright, the rest was simple. Balancing flavors. Nothing too hardcore nerdy here. Rice wine vinegar is my favorite all-purpose vinegar, and it works well in potato salad. 2 tablespoons in the cooking water, another to dress the hot potatoes, and a final 2 in the mayonnaise mixture, added plenty of layered brightness. Mayonnaise, be it store-bought or homemade, is a must. A cup and a quarter is less than average for 4 pounds of potatoes, but I like to keep the mayo a little light. By stirring the salad vigorously, you can bash off the corners of the potatoes, which get mashed up, and increase the ratio of creamy dressing to tender potato chunks. For heat, I added a few tablespoons of whole grain mustard. Dijon or even yellow would work fine if you prefer. Pickles are a point of contention in potato salad. I like to use chopped cornichons in mine, mostly because that's the type of pickle I usually have in my fridge. Chopped dills, bread and butters, or even a couple scoops of pickle relish also work just fine. Chopped celery and red onions add necessary crunch to the mix. To be honest, though, once the potatoes are properly cooked and seasoned, the dressing itself is very much a matter of personal taste. I like sugar in mine, others don't. Then again, whether or not it needs black pepper is not a matter of taste. Put in the pepper. There are few dishes much humbler than potato salad, but if you want to gussy it up a bit, you could do worse than to add a handful of chopped fresh herbs. Parsley and chives work great. I sometimes add scallion greens because they seem to spontaneously generate in my vegetable drawer. If you've saved your celery leaves, you can go fancy by using them. Now I know that there are those who like to add pickle juice, those who like to add garlic, those who add sour cream. Really, all those things could be great, and as far as flavorings go, there's no right way to make a potato salad. The keys to remember are: use russet potatoes. Cut them evenly and start them in cold water, seasoned with salt, sugar, and vinegar, 1 tablespoon of each per quart of water. Season the potatoes again with vinegar as soon as they come out of the water. Use bold flavors, because cold food tastes bland without them. With these 4 simple tips in mind, you're free to do whatever the heck you like with your potato salads. Well, whatever you want within the boundaries of the law. Experiment. Cold confusion. Our taste buds are extremely sensitive to the temperature of foods being served. How many times have you eaten cold pizza out of the fridge the next morning and thought to yourself, how could this cold, clammy, bland thing be the remains of the well-seasoned flavor bomb I was eating last night? Okay, admittedly, on the mornings I'm eating cold pizza, it's usually because I'm too hungover to care. But to prove to yourself that seasoning is temperature-dependent, try this little experiment yourself. Materials: 3 pounds carrots, peeled and cut into 1-inch chunks, 3 tablespoons butter, kosher salt, blender. Procedure: 1. Put the carrots in a large saucepan and cover them in cold water. Do not add salt. Bring to a boil over high heat and cook until the carrots are very tender. 2. Drain the carrots, reserving about 2 cups of the liquid. Place the carrots and butter in a blender, add the liquid, and puree. Make sure to start out slow and gradually increase the speed to avoid a blowout. You should have about 4 cups carrot puree. 3. Divide the puree into 4 even parts. Mix 1/2 teaspoon salt into the first batch, 1 teaspoon into the second, 1.5 teaspoons into the third, and 2 teaspoons salt into the final batch. Have a panel of tasters taste each one and write down which they feel is the best seasoned. Not the saltiest, but the best according to their own palate. 4. Refrigerate the puree overnight and repeat the tasting when the puree is cold. Results: if your friends are anything like mine, then they will have, on average, chosen a saltier batch when the puree was served cold than they did when it was served hot. This is because hot foods stimulate your taste buds, not to mention create aromatic vapors more easily than cold foods do. Cold foods need to be seasoned more aggressively than hot foods. So when seasoning your food, always make sure to taste it at the temperature it is going to be served. Marinated kale salads. I'm not sure exactly when or where marinated kale salads became a thing, but if forced to guess, I'd put my wager on 2009, in Brooklyn. That's certainly where I first started seeing it on menus. These days, it's common enough that even friends who don't cook and don't believe in Brooklyn have heard about it and probably tried it. Kale leaves are roughly chopped, massaged with dressing and salt, and allowed to sit. The beautiful thing about these salads is that kale is robust enough that the salad stays crisp and crunchy even after sitting in the fridge for days. You can make it and eat it over the course of a few days with no loss in quality. Try a little tenderness. To make marinated kale salads, I start by removing the major stems from a bunch of kale, then shredding the leaves into bite-sized strips. Some folks make the false assumption that it's the acid in the dressing or marinade that causes the tough leaves to tenderize. Actually, it's the oil that does the job. Plant leaves naturally have a waxy cuticle on them in order to protect them from rain. Haven't you seen rainwater falling on a leaf? It rolls straight off, like water off a duck's back. But this cuticle is oil-soluble, so when you massage oil into a pile of kale leaves, it removes the coating, allowing the cells underneath to acquire some controlled damage, thereby softening them. The question, then, is this. Is it necessary to pre-tenderize the greens with straight oil before dressing them, or can the dressing alone do the job? I tried it both ways, making a couple of big batches at the office for folks to try. Any day when there are extra greens in the office is a happy one. The first I tossed with olive oil, salt, and pepper, massaging the oil into the leaves and letting the kale rest for half an hour before tossing it with the dressing. The second one I tossed with the dressing alone, adding extra olive oil, salt, and pepper to compensate, and served it up immediately. The results were pretty conclusive. Pre-softened greens have a superior texture, coming out tender and crisp, as opposed to fibrous and chewy. The difference was not so great that anyone rejected the unsoftened batch, though, so if I'm in a real rush, I'll go with a direct dressing route. How to prepare kale for salads. To prepare kale for salad, start by cutting or tearing out the large central stems and discarding them. Next, hold a bunch of leaves in one hand and slice through them at the desired thickness. Repeat with the remaining leaves. Wash the greens carefully and spin dry. Taming onions bite. Let's say you happen to have an extra pungent onion. It happens to the best of us. Is there a way to tame it? I tried out a few different methods, from submerging onions in cold water for times ranging from 10 minutes to 2 hours, to chilling them, to letting them air out on the counter. Soaking the onions in a container just led to onion-scented liquid in the container, without much of a decrease in the aroma of the onions themselves. Perhaps if I'd used an unreasonably small amount of onion in an unreasonably large container, it would have diluted it more efficiently. Air drying led to milder flavor, but also to dried-out onions and a papery texture. The best method turned out to be the fastest and easiest. Just rinse away all those extra pungent compounds under running water. Warm water. The speed of chemical and physical reactions increases with temperature. Using warm water causes onions to release their volatile compounds faster. About 45 seconds is enough to rid even the most pungent onions of their kick. The next question on your mind might be, but doesn't hot water make the onion go all limp? Nope. Even if you use the hottest tap water, it generally comes out at around 140 degrees to 150 degrees Fahrenheit or so. Pectin, the main carbohydrate glue that holds plant cells together, doesn't break down until around 183 degrees Fahrenheit. There are other bits of the onion that, given enough time, will begin to soften at hot tap water temperatures, but it takes a long, long time. Don't worry. Your onions are safe here. Dressing family number 3. Dairy-based dressings. These dressings are by far the easiest to make because dairy products, as a general rule, come pre-emulsified. That's right. The creamy milk you're drinking is creamy, precisely because it has fat distributed through it in tiny, tiny droplets. With a dairy-based dressing, you never have to worry about it breaking. On the flip side, dairy-based dressings don't have nearly as long a shelf life as constructed emulsions like a vinaigrette or a mayonnaise. Cultured milk products like sour cream, yogurt, or creme fraiche are the best bases. Their thickness makes them ideal for coating leaves and vegetables evenly, while their tanginess is a natural in salads. Chopped salads. Chopped salads are a lot like the A-Team, a ragtag group of individuals with totally conflicting personalities that somehow manage to come together in a beautiful way to make the world a better place. And there's no buts about it. A chopped salad takes more time to put together than a simple green salad. First, you've got an ingredients list that's a good 3 to 5 times longer, and then you've got to chop, drain, and dress all the vegetables. But what it lacks in brevity, it makes up for in heartiness. Nothing beats a chopped salad for lunch on a picnic. Bring all the prepared ingredients with you, with the dressing in a separate container, and toss just before serving, or as a simple but tasty meal on a warm summer night. Good chopped salads are all about balancing flavors and textures. Obviously, you want plenty of crunchy elements, crisp lettuces and vegetables, along with intensely flavored bites like cheese, nuts, and cured meats. I've included some complete recipes for a few of the most classic chopped salads, but I sincerely hope it won't end there. With their minimal fuss and inexpensive ingredients, chopped salads are one of the best forums for beginning cooks to experiment in terms of combining flavors and textures to discover a style that suits them best. I hope you take the chance. The chart in the bonus PDF will show you the best way to treat chopped salad ingredients so you can put together your own combinations. When constructing a chopped salad, I always try to mix together 2 or 3 base ingredients and a secondary ingredient or two that contrasts the base ingredients texturally and flavor-wise, along with a couple of flavorful accents. The real key to a successful chopped salad is controlling moisture. Very moist ingredients like tomatoes and cucumbers should be salted in advance and left to drain in a strainer for at least 30 minutes before being blotted dry. Depending on the ingredients, a chopped salad can be dressed with any of the 3 basic salad dressing styles. A lemony vinaigrette best brings out the fresh flavors of a light cucumber and tomato-based Greek salad, while a mayo-based creamy Italian dressing is de rigueur for a classic Italian-American antipasti salad. Tangy buttermilk ranch dressing is great as a dipping sauce on a vegetable platter, but it's also the dressing of choice for a ranch-style Cobb salad. How to buy and prepare cucumbers. Cucumbers are one of the oldest cultivated vegetables, and one of my favorites. Peeled, cut, and sprinkled with a little salt, they are simultaneously savory and refreshing. They're fantastic marinated overnight in a little soy sauce, sesame oil, and red pepper flakes. The salt in the soy sauce will draw out some of their liquid, so they get a super concentrated flavor. As a stir-fry ingredient, cucumbers are one of the most underused. Oddly enough, cucumbers are one of the 2 foods my wife can't stand. The other is tomatoes. So chicken stir-fried with cucumbers, fermented bean paste, and Sichuan peppercorns is one of my quick, easy, and delicious go-to staples when she's out on a girl's night. While you can certainly simply slice whole cukes into salads, peeling and seeding them helps you make the most of their flavor and texture. Shopping and storage. In the supermarket, you're usually faced with 3 choices. American cucumbers are dense-fleshed and flavorful. They have thicker skins than most other cucumbers, so I recommend removing it. In any case, definitely give them a good scrub under cool running water to remove some of the food-grade wax that they usually come coated in. They also have lots of watery seeds that should be scraped out before use. English cucumbers usually come individually shrink-wrapped, which means that there's no need to scrub them before eating. They are not waxed. The skins are thinner than those of American cucumbers, and so can be consumed with no problem. Although English cucumbers are usually relatively seedless, They are also much more watery than their American counterparts. They are more convenient to prepare, but less flavorful. Kirby cucumbers are like small versions of American cucumbers. Thick-skinned and relatively seedless, they have the strongest flavor of the three types and a texture that can sometimes border on tough. They are best pickled. Fresh, whole cucumbers can be stored in the vegetable crisper drawer for at least a week and often much longer. Cut cucumber pieces should be stored wrapped in a moist paper towel inside an airtight plastic bag or container to prevent moisture loss. Eat cut cucumbers within 3 days. 9. Batter, breadings, and the science of frying. Honey, if you're listening to this, I'm coming clean. I've been hiding the fried chicken from you. Now I know what you're thinking. How could you do such a thing to me? My love for juicy chicken coated in a crisp crust knows no bounds. Whether it's a thick, crunchy coating with 11 secret herbs or spices, or paper-thin, crackling skin that unites with the flesh underneath to achieve that cosmic oneness so coveted by fried chicken aficionados like myself, there is nothing, I mean nothing, I'd rather be doing in this sweet, fair world right now than sinking my teeth into a golden brown thigh, feeling the snap of the skin against my lips, the salty golden juices dribbling down my chin. If you'd only let me, I'd eat fried chicken for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and several meals in between. And therein lies the problem. As passionate as I am, I'm a man of science, and in order for me to perform truly scientific tests on fried chicken, the stuff has to stick around at least long enough for me to document and measure it. This simply doesn't happen when you're in the vicinity. For the past year, I've resorted to waiting until you're out of town before cranking up the deep fryer to do my testing. You come back from trips with the smell of chicken fat still lingering in the air, the bony remains of my experiments sitting at the bottom of the trash can. It's cruel, I know, and I promise, dear, that I gain only a small bit of sadistic pleasure out of doing it. Do I not make it up to you by supplying you with increasingly better versions of fried chicken on special occasions like Christmas or Colonel Sanders' birthday? Fact is, you're not alone here. I love fried chicken. You love fried chicken. Irving, our doorman, loves fried chicken. Our dog loves fried chicken almost as much as he loves chasing his own tail. Is there anyone in this fair country who doesn't love fried chicken? As a food writer, recipe developer, kitchen scientist, and lover of American food, I see it as my responsibility, nay, my duty, to give fried chicken its due. To see exactly what it is that makes it tick, to decipher what's going on underneath that crisp golden brown shell, and to deliver to my wife the culmination of those studies. But first, a few words on deep frying. What is deep frying? If there's one cooking technique that home cooks fear more than any other, it's deep frying. I get it. Bringing a pot full of oil up to 375 degrees Fahrenheit on your stovetop is a frightening prospect. But what if I told you that despite the violent bubbling, alchemic transformation, and incredible deliciousness that results from a fry job well done, frying is actually a remarkably simple process and one of the easiest techniques to perform in the kitchen, given a bit of know-how? I mean, think about it. Who does most of the deep frying in this country? The least trained kitchen workers, that's who. Why do you think the fry station is the very first place that most beginning restaurant cooks are assigned to? All those faultlessly fried clams you get from roadside shacks in New England in the summer? Guess who's cooking them? Hint, it's not a four-star chef. Most likely it is a high school kid trying to make a few bucks over summer vacation. And if they can do it, then so can you. Here's what happens when you drop a piece of food into a deep fryer. Dehydration. Free water inside foods and in batters or breadings will evaporate at 212 degrees Fahrenheit. As soon as your food hits the oil in a deep fryer, which for most recipes ranges from 300 degrees to 400 degrees Fahrenheit, moisture will rapidly convert into steam, releasing itself in a violent cascade of bubbles. This escape of moisture is what you see when you first lower food into a fryer. Within a few minutes, depending on the thickness of your food and temperature of your fryer, most of the free moisture in your food will have completely evaporated, and the bubbling will slow down. After this, bound water from inside the food, that is, water that takes more energy to escape from its cellular prisons, will continue to be released in small streams of bubbles. Eventually, after all free and bound moisture has been expelled, you will no longer see bubbles coming from your food. At this stage, your potato chip is about as fried as it's going to get. Expansion. The phenomenon occurs in foods that are coated in a batter or dredged in a mixture leavened with baking powder, whipped egg whites, or other ingredients that cause the formation of air bubbles. Hot air takes up more space than cold air, so the rapid change in temperature that occurs when you drop food into a fryer causes the air bubbles inside the batter around a piece of fried food to expand. In that way, it's very similar to the way that a ball of dough will puff when put into a hot oven. This expansion brings lightness and crispness to fried foods. Protein coagulation. Cooking in hot oil precipitates the rapid coagulation of proteins. Just as proteins set in a loaf of bread or a pancake, giving it more structure and rigidity, so do they set in the batter or breading, coating a piece of fried food. It's this protein matrix, usually comprised of gluten in a flour-based batter or egg proteins in a basic breading, that gives rigid structure to fried foods, transforming the batter or coating into a firm solid. Browning and caramelization. The Maillard reaction, the complex string of chemical reactions that gives flavor and color to well-browned foods, as well as caramelization, the similar reaction that occurs when sugars are heated, take place rapidly at normal frying temperatures. This is what gives fried foods their enticing golden brown color and delicious flavor. Oil absorption. As water is forced out of food through evaporation, it leaves spaces behind. What moves in to take the place of that water? The only thing that can, oil from the fryer. It's an inevitable part of frying, essential to the flavor of the finished food. And, despite what many books may tell you, frying at higher temperatures will not reduce the amount of oil your food absorbs. Seem complicated? It's not. The beautiful thing about deep frying is that once you've got the right amount of oil heated to the right temperature, all of these things happen on their own, with very little direction needed from you, the cook. The wok, the best vessel for deep frying. Frying in a Dutch oven works reasonably well, but it's got its problems. Its straight sides make maneuvering food inside it difficult. You could go out and get a dedicated deep fryer, but do you really have room on your counter for that? Here's a better alternative. I'd be willing to wager that anyone who complains about how difficult and messy it is to deep fry at home has never tried deep frying in a wok. Why don't people fry at home? The most common answers are, it's messy, it's expensive, what do I do with all the leftover oil, and it's unhealthy. Well, a wok can help solve your first two problems. You're on your own for the third. Frying adds fat to your food, period. Try eating a few fewer French fries or only one piece of fried chicken if you don't want the extra calories. The flared sides of a wok offer several advantages over a straight-sided saucepan or Dutch oven. There is less mess. If you've ever tried deep frying in a Dutch oven, you know that your range gets splattered with little droplets of oil splashing out from the sizzling food inside the pot. The sloping sides of a wok, on the other hand, extend out a good 3 inches or so from where the edges of the oil are, catching those droplets and keeping your counter neat and clean. It's easier to maneuver. To get the crispest food possible, it's important to keep the food moving. More on that later. Many times, you also need to flip foods while frying. The flared shape of a wok make it easy to reach in with a spider or chopsticks, and it gives you plenty of room to work in. There is less chance of a spillover. Having a pot of hot oil bubble over the rim of a Dutch oven ain't fun. It's dangerous. The oil will probably catch fire, and, at the very least, it'll make a huge mess. It ranks up there with the old hand in the blender or dog in the dishwasher as worst kitchen nightmare ever. It happens when you add too much moist or cold food to a too full pot of oil. The food rapidly releases bubbles of water vapor. Those bubbles pile up on top of each other, and over the edges they go. Since a wok widens out at the top, there is much more volume for those bubbles to expand into, so their surface area increases, weakening their structure, and they pop before they get a chance to go up and over. It's easier to keep the oil clean, making the technique more economical. The edges of a Dutch oven can harbor burnt breadcrumbs, little bits of French fries, and other such baddies. In a wok, there's no place to hide. Food particles left in hot oil are the main reason the oil breaks down and becomes unusable. Oil that's carefully cleaned as you cook should last for at least a dozen frying sessions, if not more. The keys to perfect deep frying. No matter what cooking vessel you choose, here are 10 tips to ensure that your frying will be successful. Use a thermometer. There's no other way to ensure that your oil is at the right temperature. Depending on what you're cooking, you'll want to use different oil temperatures. For example, French fries fried at 300 degrees Fahrenheit will never crisp up, and chicken fried at 425 degrees Fahrenheit will burn on the exterior before it's cooked through. A thermometer is the only way to guarantee that you're cooking things right. You can get a dedicated deep-frying thermometer, but if you already own a thermopen, and you should, it'll do the job even better. Don't fear the fat. A hot wok of oil is nothing to be trifled with, but just like a pit bull, it can sense fear. Timid novice fryers often decide to keep their hands a safe distance from the oil by dropping the food into it from a height. The food ends up splashing hot oil out of the wok and onto their skin and clothes, making them even more scared the next time. The goal when adding food to a fryer should be to minimize splashing. You do this by bringing your hand, or tongs if you're using them, as close to the surface of the oil as possible before dropping in the food. For small pieces of food, a couple of inches or less. This means getting your fingers to about an inch above the oil as you add each one. For larger pieces, a whole fish fillet, say, it means dipping in one end and then gently lowering the fillet into the oil until only the last inch sticks out before dropping it. Lowering foods into the oil a piece at a time will also keep battered items from sticking together in a large mass. Avoid crowds. Adding too much food into the hot oil in a single batch will cause the oil temperature to drop rapidly, reducing the effectiveness of your fry. Your food won't crisp properly, and batter-coated foods may lose some of their coating. A good rule of thumb is to never add more than a half a pound of refrigerator temperature food per quart of hot oil. So, if you want to cook that 1 pound batch of fries, you've got to use a full half gallon of oil, or go in batches. I suggest batches. Of course, frozen food should be fried in even smaller batches. Dry equals good. As we've discussed, deep frying is essentially a process of dehydration. The hot oil causes water to rapidly transform to steam, which escapes and allows the crust to form. So it stands to reason that the drier your food is to begin with, the more effectively it'll fry. Surface moisture can also cause undue bubbling and more rapid breakdown of the oil. For best results, all solid foods to be fried should first be patted dry or coated with a batter or breading. And make sure to allow excess batter to drip off foods before adding them to the oil. Keep it clean. The more you use a batch of oil, the less effective its frying ability will become. The main factors that affect oil breakdown are small particles of food and moisture. To extend the life of your fry oil, you should constantly clean it. Whenever I fry, I keep a wire mesh spider nearby to fish out any breadcrumbs, bits of tempura batter, or other food particles between or even during batches. To remove this debris, I start by swirling the oil in a clockwise direction with the spider, then flip the spider around and give it a pass in the counterclockwise direction. The flow of the oil should force the majority of food particles into its mesh. Deposit the debris into a metal bowl kept handy do not throw into a garbage can with a plastic liner, and repeat until the oil is clean. After each frying session, pour the oil through a fine mesh strainer lined with paper towels or cheesecloth set over a bowl to get rid of any leftover detritus. Keep it moving. Ever notice how when you're in a cool swimming pool, if you stand still, you'll feel a little warmer until someone swims by and creates a current around you that cools you down again? Well, the opposite thing happens with cold food in hot oil. If you allow it to sit still, a pocket of cooler air will develop around pieces of food, reducing the effectiveness of the fry. By constantly agitating the food and moving it around, you're continuously exposing it to fresh hot oil. Your food will fry more evenly and come out crisper than the simpler dunk-and-sit method. A wire mesh spider or a pair of long chopsticks is the best tool for this job. Choose your oil wisely. The best oils for deep frying are relatively cheap, flavorless oils with high smoke points. Flavorful oils like sesame oil or extra virgin olive oil contain compounds that cause them to smoke at far below the effective frying temperature for most foods. Other oils have their adherence, but peanut oil or peanut oil cut with a bit of lard, bacon fat, and shortening is my frying medium of choice. Drain quickly and use paper towels. While it may seem logical to drain fried foods on a metal rack, it's actually far more effective to drain them on a paper towel-lined plate or bowl. When they are set on a rack, very little oil actually drips out of the food. The oil's surface tension keeps it in place. A paper towel, on the other hand, wicks oil away through capillary action, effectively drawing more fat out of the food and helping it stay crisp longer. In fact, in a side-by-side test, I found that paper towels drew out nearly 4 times as much oil from the food as a simple rest on the rack. To get the least greasy food possible, drop your food directly from the fryer onto a paper towel-lined plate, tray, or bowl, flip it to blot oil on both sides, and then quickly transfer it to a rack to allow for circulation. Steam building up under the food can soften its crust. Season immediately. I worked for a chef who was fond of saying, "I don't care if you just fried dog s." If it comes out of the fryer, you season it the second it does. And he's right. Salt sticks to and dissolves more rapidly on hot surfaces. So the sooner you season your fried food, the better it'll taste down the line. Reuse your oil. To save your oil, skim it and let it cool in the wok. Then pour it through a fine mesh strainer lined with cheesecloth or a paper towel. From there, pour it right back into its original bottle or an empty soda bottle through a funnel. Seal the cap and store it in a cool, dark cabinet until the next time you need it. If it starts getting very dark or produces foamy bubbles on its surface when you start heating it, it's past its prime and should be disposed of. All about oil. What's the best oil for deep frying? There's a baffling array of fats on supermarket shelves these days, from supposedly heart-healthy olive and canola oils, high in omega-3 fatty acids, to expensive designer oils like avocado or grapeseed, to solid at room temperature fats like vegetable shortening and lard. Which fat is best for frying? Which produces the crispest crust and best flavor? I decided to find out the only way I know how. Try them all. I fried a dozen batches of chicken using the following fats: shortening, lard, canola oil, olive oil, peanut oil, sunflower oil, corn oil, palm oil, avocado oil, generic vegetable oil, usually a mix of soybean and corn oil, grapeseed oil, and bacon fat. I immediately noticed a direct correlation between the level of saturated fat in a given cooking medium and how crisp the chicken got. Chicken cooked in highly saturated lard, 40% saturated fat, shortening, 31%, bacon fat, 40%, or palm oil, 81%, was by far the crunchiest. This seems like a good thing until you actually let it cool a bit and eat it. Because those fats are all close to solid at body temperature, they leave your mouth with an unappetizing, waxy coating. With lighter foods like tempura-style vegetables or fish, this coating is especially noticeable. On the opposite end of the spectrum, chicken fried in highly unsaturated fats like grapeseed, 10 to 12% saturated fat, olive, 13%, corn, 13%, sunflower, 10%, avocado, 12%, or vegetable oil, around 13%, suffered from the opposite problem. The chicken simply didn't crisp up as well. The winner? Peanut oil, with its moderately high level of saturated fat, 17%, and clean, neutral flavor. The chicken fried up clean and crisp, without any of the mouth-coating waxiness of the highly saturated fats. It's my fat of choice for almost all frying projects, not just chicken. Saturated versus unsaturated fat. We hear the terms saturated fat and unsaturated fat thrown about often. But what do they really mean, and how do they affect your cooking? Like most organic compounds, fats are pretty complicated molecules. They're naturally kinked and wound up, but if you were to straighten one out, it would resemble the letter uppercase E, with a molecule of glycerol forming the spine and long chains of carbon atoms called fatty acids forming the three arms. It's the exact makeup of these arms that determines whether or not a fat is saturated. A carbon atom can form four bonds with other atoms. In saturated fats, every carbon atom in the chain is bonded to two hydrogen atoms, along with the carbon atom preceding it and following it. In unsaturated fats, one or more of the carbon atoms is bound only to a single hydrogen. In place of the missing hydrogen, it forms a double bond with a neighboring carbon atom. Monounsaturated fats contain a single double carbon bond, while polyunsaturated fats contain two or more double carbon bonds. Because saturated fat molecules are straight, they can stack together more tightly and efficiently, rendering most of them solid at room temperature. That's why fats with a high proportion of saturated fat, such as butter, shortening, animal fats, and palm oil, will be solid and opaque at room temperature, turning clear and liquid only when they are heated. Highly unsaturated fats like canola or olive oil, on the other hand, remain clear and liquid at room temperature because their molecules have a tough time packing together in an organized manner. It gets even more complicated when you take into account trans and cis fats, terms used to describe the geometry of unsaturated fats. Trans fats are unsaturated fats in which the double carbon bond is formed in such a way that the resulting fatty acid is straight. A cis fat has its double carbon bond formed in a way that makes the fatty acid kink, like a boomerang. While both formations occur in nature, trans fats are commonly found in animal fats. Trans fats are far more abundant in hydrogenated fats, man-made fats in which the hydrogen atoms have been forced to bond with polyunsaturated fats to increase their saturation. Margarine and some types of shortening are examples of hydrogenated fats. Current research indicates that trans fats have been positively linked to coronary artery disease. As a result, artificial trans fats are banned in some areas. Modern shortening products are manufactured in ways that minimize the amount of trans fat that makes it into the final tub. My mother used to keep a jar of bacon grease in her fridge that she swore was the key to the best fried chicken. Anything to that? Indeed, bacon fat is not only highly saturated, making for that extra crunchy coating, but it also adds flavor of its own. This can be a great thing for dishes like fried chicken or chicken fried steak, as long as you don't use so much that it becomes overpowering. A ratio of 1:7 is ideal. That is, for every 4 cups peanut oil you use, replace 1/2 cup of it with rendered bacon fat. Avoid using bacon fat for more delicate things like vegetables or fish. I've heard that if you fry fish in oil, it can make the oil smell fishy. Any truth in that? At one point or another, you've probably walked into a restaurant or perhaps a neighbor's home and immediately caught a whiff of rancid, fishy-smelling oil. You may even have said to your host, or if you are more restrained than I have been in the past, to yourself, "Oof, somebody frying fish in here?" Well, here's the thing. I've got both a fried fish shop and a fried chicken shop right on my block in Harlem. Oddly enough, it's the fried chicken joint that smells like rancid, fishy oil, while the fried fish shop smells only of fresh seafood. What gives? Turns out that the fishy oil smell you get from fried foods has nothing to do with the fish itself. It's caused by the inexorable breakdown of fat molecules. Hang on a minute. Breakdown of fat molecules? Sounds to me like you're talking about oxidation and hydrolysis. Can you explain yourself? No problem. Remember high school biology, where we learned that a fat molecule is made up of three fatty acids attached to a glycerol backbone, all arranged in a large uppercase E shape? Well, the problem is that these fat molecules are not exactly stable. Given exposure to oxygen and enough time, they break down, and this gradual breakdown is sped up by exposure to heat, light, and air. Unfortunately, when you fry, all three of these types of exposure occur in abundance. On its own, exposure to oxygen causes oxidation, a process that causes the large fat molecules to break down, resulting in many smaller molecules, among them ketones and short-chain fatty acids. These are the foul-smelling molecules that are the true cause of that fishy smell in fry shops, and this type of reaction occurs even when you don't add any food to the hot oil. In extreme cases, it can even occur in poorly stored bottles of oil. For this reason, you should never store your oil near the stove. You're simply inviting rancidification. Once you actually start frying things, it gets worse. Hydrolysis, a reaction that occurs when you combine water, oil, and heat, that is, fry something, compounds and speeds up the effects of oxidation. That's why oil used for frying eventually breaks down and becomes stinky and unusable. Depending on how hot you fry and how much food you fry at a time, a container of oil will get anywhere from a half dozen to a few score of uses before it becomes unusable. Finally, the last way in which oil breaks down is a process called saponification. Literally, the conversion of oil to soap. And when we say soap, we're not talking ivory or Dove bars, we're talking about the chemical definition, a chemical salt of a fatty acid. Soaps are a surfactant, which means they have a hydrophobic, oil-loving, water-hating end, and a hydrophilic, water-loving, oil-hating end. They are the peacemakers of the oil and water world, allowing the two to coexist without separating, as they are wont to do. In this case, though, peaceful coexistence is a bad thing. The more surfactants your oil contains, the more water it can hold, the faster hydrolysis will occur, the lower the smoke point of your oil will be, and the less efficient it will be as a frying medium. As it turns out, the fried chicken joint in my neighborhood smells fishy not because it is storing old fish under the counter, but because it doesn't filter or change the oil frequently enough. The fried fish shop, on the other hand, changes its oil regularly, leaving only the aroma of its fresh fish to linger in the air. Guess which restaurant has the longer line? What about at home? How many times can I reuse my oil? When frying at home, you can expect to use the same batch of oil for 6 to 8 frying sessions before it begins to break down. Certain foods will cause oil to break down faster than others. In general, the smaller the particles in your breading or batter, the faster your oil will break down. Thus, fried chicken that's dredged in flour will ruin your oil faster than eggplant slices breaded in chunkier breadcrumbs, which in turn will break down your oil faster than onion rings dipped in a batter that turns solid when fried. How come a restaurant is able to reuse its oil so many more times than I can at home? This is because of one of the major advantages commercial deep fryers have over home setups. They are not heated from the bottom. Restaurant deep fryers have electric or gas-powered heating elements that are several inches above the base of the fryer. What does this mean? One of the biggest problems with deep frying is the buildup of detritus in the fat. Bits of batter, flour, and breadcrumbs all fall off your food when you drop it in the fryer and stay there after you take your cooked food out. What happens to this debris? Eventually, it completely dehydrates and subsequently sinks to the very bottom of the oil. In a restaurant fryer, this isn't much of a problem. The debris sits in the relatively cool section of oil underneath the heating element. At home, however, your wok or pot of oil is heated directly from underneath. Fallen particles burn, wreaking havoc on the quality of your oil and sticking to subsequent batches of food you drop into it. So, what can you do at home? The key to preventing the oil from ruining your meal is to be very meticulous about cleaning it between batches of food and between frying. There are also some countertop, small-scale electric deep fryers that have heating elements that work like the restaurant fryers, allowing you to get more out of your oil in the long run. However, they also take up a counter space, and most take a long time to heat up. The trade-off is largely a matter of personal preference. Any other advantages to a restaurant deep fryer? Restaurant deep fat fryers are designed for volume. Most have a capacity of at least 10 gallons. At home, you're more likely to be cooking with a couple of quarts of oil at most, about 20 times less. The advantage of using a ton of oil is easier temperature management. Drop a handful of room temperature French fries into 10 gallons of 375 degree Fahrenheit oil, and it'll lose, at most, a degree or two. Do the same in 2 quarts of oil, and you're looking at a drop closer to 50 degrees. So, at home, you have to heat your oil hotter in order to compensate for this loss. Okay, I think I've got it. New oil equals good, old oil equals bad, right? Not necessarily. You may think that using fresh new oil is the best way to fry foods, and you would be forgiven for thinking that. Forgiven, but wrong. Here's why. Completely fresh oil is highly hydrophobic. It doesn't want to get anywhere near water. Any food that you drop into a deep fryer is bound to have a very large percentage of water in it. After all, the whole point of frying is to drive off water, which means that the oil is not going to like it. It hates it so much, in fact, that it has trouble getting close to its surface. Have you ever noticed that when you drop battered food into fresh oil, there's a shiny bubble that forms around the food? That's a layer of water vapor rapidly escaping from